flying in the third world towards the people stranded on their knees.
David Rovix is a singer-songwriter from the United States who has become a strong voice through song for various grassroots movements for social justice around the world, from the ongoing fight against corporate globalization defined in free trade accords such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas, to the growing solidarity movement in support of the Palestinian resistance to the illegal Israeli occupation. Since the mid-90s, David Rovix has been spending most of his time on tour, playing concerts around the US, Canada, and various countries in Europe. David Rovix recently came to Montreal to play a show which focused on the current construction of what is being called the Apartheid Wall throughout the West Bank and Palestine. The Apartheid Wall, 8 meters high, will annex 10% of the West Bank, Israel justifying the wall as a security perimeter. I had a chance to sit down with David Rovix while he was in Montreal to speak to him about his music and his take on Palestinian solidarity movement, while offering his perspectives on various movements for social justice in Canada and around the world.
So much about Israel and the Israeli apartheid state and U.S. is, whether it's Clinton or Bush or whoever, you know, always saying that they're supporting democracy and supporting freedom and all this kind of thing. And they have to stop evil regimes like the Ba'ath Party in Iraq because they invade their neighbors and they have weapons of mass destruction and yada yada. And everything they say is applicable to Israel, only on a much, much larger, more horrific scale. You know, if you compare the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, or the weapons of mass destruction that Iraq has to the weapons of mass destruction, the 200 nuclear weapons that Israel has, and the hypocrisy is just, you know, screaming at you. And I guess I just keep on, you know, for whatever reason, I'm not sure how random it is and how much, you know, for what the factors are here, but I just keep on running into Palestinians all over the place. And so, you know, I hear about what's going on. I guess if I were running into that many Tibetans, maybe I'd be writing more about Tibet. But, you know, it seems like there's some level of randomness to the whole thing, to what I end up writing about, because I kind of feel a bit like a sponge, kind of like, you know, when I'm hearing about things that are going on, I write about them, and I guess it's sort of inevitable, but I think there's also a real, you know, a real clear, you know, reason why this should be a focus, not only for myself, but for lots of people, especially people from the U.S., because, you know, it's just such an outrageous contradiction. And also as a Jew, I don't self-identify that way, I'm not religious or anything, but I'm of Jewish lineage, and for me, you know, being of Jewish lineage, the contradictions are also just incredibly outrageous, that, you know, Jews talk so much about, you know, never again, the Holocaust, and then, you know, it seems to me that you can't possibly be a moral human being, Jewish or otherwise, and say never again to the Holocaust, and not also say never again to Sabra and Shatila, and never again to, you know, apartheid. You can't oppose South African apartheid without opposing Israeli apartheid when you look at it and realize that Israeli apartheid is, you know, if we have to compare things, you know, I'd say clearly, you know, worse, much worse than the South African apartheid ever was.
Quite a few of the songs that you sang last night focus on the realities on the ground in Palestine. You sang a song about Jenin. Can you talk about different reactions that you've got in the United States to these songs from, you know, a variety of people, whether Palestinians or Jews or people involved in anti-capitalist struggles? I mean, what has the general reaction been?
It's really interesting because, like, you know, when I'll write a song about something, whatever it might be, you know, sometimes I just feel like, well, I'm not on a record label. Well, now I'm on a very small record label, but, you know, generally not on a record label, don't have distribution, don't have, you know, much radio play. And so, you know, I'll write a song or record a CD and I'll just wonder, like, you know, is anybody actually out there? Is there any purpose to doing this? Is anybody listening? Is, you know, and, but then I notice that when I write a song on certain subjects, somehow or other, through no particular extra effort on my part, somehow or other, this stuff just gets out there. And the way that the internet works, it's like once something gets out there, then it just that snowballs. And so, usually, when I write a new song, even if it's just not even an MP3 getting on the web, but just the lyrics, which is also a little embarrassing because these are not poems and they don't really work as poems. They really work as songs. So I'm always kind of hesitant to even just put the lyrics out there because they're really not meant to be read. They're meant to be sung. But, when something gets out there, it just spreads around every time I write a song on the subject of Palestine. And I always get a lot of emails and phone calls and reaction of all sorts, and it's always keeps life interesting. Most of the reaction that I get is really positive. I hear especially from Palestinians and other Arabs from throughout the diaspora all over the world. I fairly regularly get phone calls from just random people calling up from Egypt or London or someplace, some Palestinian somewhere in the world, or emails like that, and they probably the positive reactions probably outnumber the negative about 10 to 1, but the negative reactions are also get quite a bit of hate mail from Zionists, mostly from Jewish Zionists, but also I also get a lot of positive emails from Jewish anti-Zionists, but the negative stuff is it's I guess the more interesting to talk about, really, just because it's it's because it's more controversial. I've been banned from one Baptist minister called me in Hartford, Connecticut, said I was a anti-American, anti-Christian, pro-terrorist, and canceled a concert that was to take place in his church, sponsored by the Ocotal, Nicaragua, Hartford City Sister City Project. He canceled the concert and banned me from his church, and also said on an email list to the Greater Hartford Area Council of Churches that anyone who had me play in their church would be kicked out of the Council of Churches. So this guy was pissed. And then sort of ironically or not, the concert did go forward under the auspices of the Quakers in a Jewish cultural center in Hartford. And it was still a benefit for the same Sister City Project, but they couldn't sponsor it because they were part of the Greater Hartford Area Council of Churches. I guess the biggest controversy that was when I wrote the first song I wrote on the subject of Children of Jerusalem, which is on Living in These Times, and I wrote that just at the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, just after Sharon visited the mosque and provoked the response that he got, and then started massacring people, I was about to do what would have been my second tour of Israel, and having at that point not made any contacts in the occupied territories, but I was just sort of like, I was just going to do another tour of Israel, and felt pretty ambivalent about it for a variety of reasons. The first tour of Israel was pretty bizarre, but I was also interested in getting to know the people there better, just because largely because I just found it kind of fascinating. I had never encountered such an incredibly racist society in my life, and I was kind of fascinated to understand how these people worked, and what made them tick. And so the tour was canceled, and that was also sort of an interesting sociological understanding of Israeli society, because I think it kind of represents the breakdown of the mainstream. And of course, since then I've been in touch with so many great, real radical real pro-Palestinian Israelis. But at that time, this was in Israeli folk music scene, which is definitely not a radical or a conservative. I mean, it's just mainstream Israelis basically are into folk music, and just like here, it's not like these are particularly more left or right than the average, perhaps slightly left of center if anything. but probably not, because these are English-speaking folk people. So then, you know, they're also representing the more conservative elements of Israeli society who come from North America and Australia and England. And out of the 10 gigs I was going to have on that tour, 8 of the 10 wrote me and in either called me some combination of fascist, neo-fascist, Nazi, neo-Nazi, self-loathing Jew, or anti-Semite. And, you know, some wrote me little emails and some wrote me like really long ones. And they were clearly really disturbed by the fact that I would write this song, because they felt like I was kind of like one of them. They liked my music, that I, you know, they wanted me back. And, you know, eight of the 10 wrote like that. One wrote and said, you know, I understand your sentiment, but you better not come here because nobody would come to your show anyway. And then one guy wrote me, Moshe Landsman, wonderful guy, psychiatrist who regularly goes to Gaza and works with child trauma survivors. He wrote me and said, yeah, I think Sharon's a fascist too. Great song. I look forward to hearing it. And that was, you know, I think unfortunately that really represents the breakdown of opinion within Israeli society. And, you know, perhaps, hopefully that's not too generous to say that 10% of the people there are, you know, have their heads screwed on straight and the rest are racist wing nuts.
Can you talk about your song, Janine?
Oh, yeah. I read about, you know, I was hearing on the radio and reading about the invasion of the city of Janine, and which I guess was really wasn't even as horrific as the invasion of Nablus, but I guess there were more reporters in Janine at the time. I didn't realize that at the time, but I since then have found out that, you know, that initial invasion of Janine in, what was it, 2001? Or I guess but, you know, I was reading about how they were just, you know, bulldozing the whole place and not giving people warning before bulldozing the place. And it just seemed like such a perfect, story to try to explain, you know, where these suicide bombers come from, because, you know, they don't come out of a vacuum, obviously, and they don't come out of, you know, I think quite simply, they don't come out of religious fundamentalism. They come out of, you know, they come out of the circumstances. I haven't been there and I haven't talked to any suicide bombers, and, you know, I don't know firsthand, but it seems to me that, you know, I'd be surprised if a lot of people carrying out these kinds of operations even believe in heaven or hell or 72 virgins or any of that kind of stuff. I doubt they even believe that stuff. I think it's just an act of desperation and defiance and people using the resources that are at hand, and they don't have F-16s and helicopter gunships. What they have are their bodies and very simple explosive devices and nails, and, you know, and that's what they're using. I think that any person with a heart can understand, you know, when you've seen your parents, you know, humiliated and killed and tortured and your community completely destroyed, and you know that people on the other side of the Green Line are living in Western opulence, and, you know, it doesn't take it, I think really any moron should be able to understand that the motivation that would draw somebody to decide, well, you know, they're the enemy, and it doesn't matter whether they're so-called civilians or so-called military, they're the enemy. I'm not saying that I, you know, agree entirely with that analysis, but I think that it's very easy to sympathize and empathize and understand, and anybody who doesn't is really, there's something wrong with them. And so I wrote the song about the invasion of Janine using my favorite songwriting tactic of the surprise ending, you know, describing the situation in Janine and then waiting till the last line to say, you know, and then the guy got on the bus and blew himself up. And I think it's a really, it's one of many really, really powerful songwriting or storytelling or poem writing or whatever tactics, because, you know, with the, you know, when you're describing the devastation and what the person is going through, you know, hiding in the basement while the tanks are going by, and, you know, seeing his mother dead in the rubble, and, you know, this kind of thing that people were going through. You know, most people can really empathize with that. And once you have opened their hearts to really empathizing with the plight of some teenager from Jenin, going through what so many other teenagers from Jenin have gone through, and you know, you got them with you, then you spring on them, okay, and then the guy got on the bus and blew himself up. And then they're hopefully, you know, my hope writing a song like that is that when by the time they're with you and you get them to that last line, if they hadn't really empathized with a suicide bomber before and really understood where they were coming through, hopefully when they hear that last line, they'll at least have a moment of empathizing.
Why should anybody wonder, as you stepped on board, the crowded bus across the green line, and you reached inside your jacket for the cord? Were you thinking of your neighbor's buried bodies as you made the stage for this scene, as you set off the explosives that were strapped around your waist? Were you thinking of the city of Jenin?
You're going to be going to the occupied territories to play some shows, which is in coordination with activists from the International Solidarity Movement. Can you speak about, from your perspective, how the ISM has influenced the Palestinian Solidarity Movement in the United States? Obviously, a movement that you're part of, that your music is part of. You're going to be going there as an American, as somebody who has sang many songs about the situation on the ground in the occupied territories. Why do you think that this is important? You going there, seeing directly what's happening, bringing your words, bringing your ideas of the realities on the ground with you, but at the same time being directly engaged with the situation on the ground as an American, but also as a songwriter.
I guess... I just expressed interest to George Wishmawi and other folks with ISM, you know, I guess a couple years ago, first time, maybe, just saying that, you know, if they wanted to have to set up a concert tour in the occupied territories, that I'd totally be into doing it. And so I just left it up to them to decide whether they thought that was useful. So I guess... On the one hand, I'd say, you know, ask them why they think it might be useful. But as far as I'm concerned, why I think it might be useful, I guess, is just for the same reason that I think music has power anyway, anywhere in the world, which is, when you can tell people's story for them, then... That's powerful somehow. I mean, just in the same way as, you know, it's powerful to listen to free speech radio news or something. I mean, you know, it's, you're hearing these stories, you're hearing someone tell these stories, and somehow it gives the stories and gives the people and gives their struggles some slight degree of more legitimacy when someone tells the story. I don't know exactly why that is, but it is that way, and it affects people. And I think that, you know, I think there's also, I think we also have to challenge in as many ways as possible, challenge this idea that there's some kind of a religious conflict going on, you know, challenge this idea that, you know, Jews don't go to the occupied territories, or Palestinians don't like Jews or something like that. I mean, it's just complete crock, really. And, you know, I mean, there's going to be lots of bad feeling, and some of that bad feeling is going to be expressed in crass ways that maybe we don't, but people are people, and it's inevitable that there's going to be, when the people oppressing you, I mean, just like in the United States, just like, you know, when the people oppressing you are all one, from one background, then you're gonna, you know, then some people are gonna, you know, draw sort of, make general conclusions about those people, and that's unfortunate but understandable. But you know, what I've noticed, of course, is that, you know, huge numbers of Palestinians see through that and understand that the enemy is not Jews generally or even Israelis generally, which is kind of a stretch. But, you know, they know that there are good people in Israel and some good people in Israel, and that there are good people within the Jewish diaspora as well. And I think it's important for everybody, both for Jews generally, for Americans, for Palestinians, for all of us to understand that this is not a Jewish Muslim conflict. This is not a that's not the nature of the conflict. The nature of the conflict is occupiers mostly coming from Europe and North America to, you know, steal people's land and oppress them, and that's the crux of the thing, and they do it in the name of Judaism, and they don't represent Judaism, and they even though most American Jews are not actively anti-Zionist, it's interesting that in a recent poll I read about, I think it was like Gallup or some other mainstream poll, only something like, I think it was like 22% of American Jews self-identify as Zionists. Which of course, doesn't mean that they're actively anti-Zionist, but they don't identify as Zionists. They don't identify with Zionism. They don't feel represented by the Israeli state. Unfortunately, they're not doing a whole lot about it. But I think it's interesting, you know, that it, you know, Israel does not represent Jews, and most Jews don't even live there. There's more Jews in New York than there are in Israel, I believe.
You have often played your music and your songs within the context of social justice movements in the United States at various convergences or demonstrations against capitalist globalization, institutions like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the Group of Eight, the G8, but also have sung your music in support of the Palestinian struggle or different anti-colonial struggles. What is your perspectives on the links between, both through your music, but also in terms of movements on the ground, social movements on the ground in the United States, links between, you know, movements in support of Palestinian resistance or anti-colonial struggles, and, you know, these large street demonstrations and mobilizations we've seen, you know, opposing the World Bank or the IMF?
It's all intimately related, and it's so vital. I mean, the reason why I like to try to really write songs about a whole variety of different so-called issues is that, they are really all one issue. And of course, you know, it may not, I mean, I understand that may not feel like the case to somebody who's on the ground in Gaza getting fired on by, you know, Israeli tanks. You know, the issue seems, you know, is the occupation, and, you know, that makes perfect sense. But I think from a more detached, perspective of a, you know, white middle-class guy from the suburbs of New York, I think that, you know, and of course, not that you have to be of that kind of background to understand the interconnectedness. That's certainly not at all the case. But, you know, I think, you know, many of us around the world understand that, you know, really U.S. military policy, for example, is just the flip side of the coin of U.S. economic policy. And we see that over and over again, you know, basically where, you know, the IMF is used as a tool to try to get countries to cooperate without military pressure. And if they won't, you know, so do this so-called opening up of their economies to, you know, exploitation and, theft by the multinational corporate elite, if they can't be bought off and bribed and coerced through the IMF, then the military is the next right around the corner, the next way that the U.S. will try to get their way, the interconnectedness between the struggle of people for living wage and the struggle of people for clean air and clean water and the struggle of people for self-determination. These are all absolutely intimately linked, and even to the point where I'd say it's all the same struggle. It's all the international class war. It's all the conflict between the haves and the have-nots, and people may not identify that way. I mean, you know, much of the environmental movement, for example, doesn't necessarily identify with the have-nots of the world. There, much of the environmental movement, you know, and certainly by no means all of it, but much of it comes from a very middle-class background and are, you know, concerned with, you know, legitimately and earnestly concerned with, you know, things like clean air and clean water and having wilderness not be clear-cut. But I think the key for the growth of the environmental movement and so many other movements is to understand this interconnectedness. And it's happening gradually that, for example, you know, environmentalists understand that actually, you know, sustainable logging employs like 20 times as many loggers as clear cutting, and you know, you still get, and ultimately you get more out of the forests. It's better for all of us in terms of what we can do with that wood, and the forests actually, you know, don't suffer in the least if you do sustainable logging. Actually, sustainably, you can do it indefinitely, and employ 20 times as many people, and the only people that suffer are the multinational capitalist elite. And even them, I mean, not that I really care about them in the least, but even them, if they had any kind of long-term perspective, they would be better off as well. Because, you know, when you clear-cut a forest, from what I remember reading, you know, in one year, you make as much profit as you would make in 20 years of sustainable logging. But then, after 20 years, the forest is still clear cut, and those trees haven't really grown back to the point where you can get that kind of yield out of them. So if you had a long-term perspective, then sustainable logging after 20 years ends up being more profitable than clear cutting and employs more people. So it's really, in so many ways, I mean, not everything is a win-win solution like that, but there are so many win-win scenarios like that that just are not being pursued because of the just outrageous short-sightedness of the you know, multinational capitalist elite who are really thinking in terms of quarterly returns.
One more question. A lot of your music is connected with, you know, a variety of social justice movements, as you just talked about, you know, whether movements opposing capitalist globalization or movements in support of the sustainability of our environment. They're interconnected with social justice movements. What drives you to be a musician or a songwriter within this context? I mean, as a songwriter, you know, who is intimately linked with these movements, how do you see artistic expression as, you know, a vital part of these movements?
I think that part of it comes down to communication. And I think so much of our job really is to get the word out and communicate in so many ways, in ways that people can hear, both intellectually and emotionally, so that you can really explain situations for them and try to create situations, try to bring them to where whatever it is you're talking about, you know. And if they're not going to actually go see an old growth forest, then try to sing a song that brings them to that place and to understand the value of this. Or if they're not going to actually be an unemployed miner, try to sing a song that or tell a story or do a news story or write a book or whatever that brings them into the shoes of the unemployed miner, so they understand what it's like to be them. And of course, if they're not going to actually be a Palestinian in the West Bank, you know, then, and of course, I'm not any of those things either. But, you know, try to get yourself into those shoes and tell that story in such a way that you could bring somebody else there. That's one aspect of it. And I think basically, you know, the media generally, and I include songwriting in that, is such a vital thing. It is. I mean, when we think about, you know, what does it mean to actually sort of influence society? What does it mean, even, you know, even what does it mean to have state power? You know, this, the media is central to that. And whether or not that's our goal, to seize state power, to influence society, or however we want to put it, or whatever our goal is, the media is absolutely central. And, you know, in so many cases, you see, like, oh, I don't know, recent events in Venezuela with the coup, the attempted coup in Venezuela, when they managed to shut down the public television station. You know, the for Chavez and his government, their primary first goal was to get the television station back online so they could tell the people of Venezuela that he had not resigned, that the coup was, that not going to win, and that the people needed to get out on the streets and support the government. And it was only once they were able to get the station back that millions of Venezuelan poured into the streets, and it became immediately clear to the government that there was no way that they were going to, it became clear to the coup plotters, there was no way they were going to be able to maintain this, because, unless they had a monopoly on the media, then the people of Venezuela would make their preference for which government they preferred quite clear, and they did. And, all social movements, and it may not be that common that you can make these kinds of generalizations, but I think in this case you can make a generalization that every social movement in the world that's ever existed has had music, and the pulse of a social movement, and really whether it is a vibrant movement, can be measured by how much art and music it's creating, and whether people are inspired to join it, and whether it's a real mass movement, can be measured that way. And and without having a real great intellectual analysis, I think you can see that the civil rights movement, for example, was a vibrant social movement, and the labor movement in the 30s was a vibrant social movement. And I'm talking, of course, in the U.S. context here, but and you can see that the labor movement currently in the U.S. is not a vibrant social movement. I mean, which is not to say that there's not great local unions and great organizers out there, but it's not what it was. And the AFL-CIO is not, inspiring people into action and producing great music. But, for example, the Palestinian struggle in Palestine and within the Palestinian diaspora is a vibrant social movement. It's creating huge amounts of great music and poetry, and both from written by Palestinians themselves and written by all kinds of other people who support them. And I always like to say that, you can see, where the people are at, to use that, term, by you can see, for example, that there are probably millions, and certainly thousands, you can easily find thousands, and probably if you looked hard enough, millions of songs that have been written about bank robbers. Bank robbing is a popular thing. People like bank robbing. That's an attractive prospect to rob banks. We can see how people feel about banks because there's loads and loads of songs about bank robbers. I don't know of a single song that's sympathetic to a bank owner, we can see where the people are at. That owning banks and running banks has never been a popular movement. Robbing banks has been popular and is popular.
You have been listening to an interview with David Rovics, a singer-songwriter from the United States, who has become a strong voice through song for various grassroots movements for social justice around the world, from the ongoing fight against corporate globalization, defined in free trade accords such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas, FTAA, to the growing solidarity movement in support of the Palestinian resistance to the illegal Israeli occupation. To get more information about David Rovics and his music, visit www.davidrovics.com. That's www.davidrovics.com. This interview was produced for CKUT Radio in Montreal by Stefan Christoph.
The soldiers raped my mother, and they killed her dead, along with the rest of the Shatila camp, while I hid beneath my bed. I'm a wanderer, no place to call my home, Palestine. All around the world I roam. My aunt came over from Jordan, brought me there to live, and together we've moved to half the world situation.